All right. Well, does anybody need a copy of the outlines? We're going to be talking about Rudolf Bultmann, Jesus and the Word. We'll very briefly mention Alfred Kinsey and his work, and then we'll move on to Theodore Adorno and his very important book entitled The Authoritarian Personality. So, all right. So, first book up is Rudolf Bultmann. A title, Jesus and the Word, sounds benign enough, sounds like the kind of book any good Christian would want to read, but I'd encourage you to read it, but read it with discretion and with discernment. There should come a reader's warning with this book, as probably all the books that we've talked about up to this point. Now, for those who for evangelicals who would consider somebody like Karl Barth to be a liberal, Karl Barth, probably the preeminent, at least in the popular mindset, probably the preeminent theologian of the 20th century, Karl Barth was actually not a liberal, strictly speaking. He was neo-orthodox, and I make that distinction in the book on bibliology that some of you have read. But Rudolf Bultmann truly is a liberal. I mean, this man really defines theological liberalism in the 20th century. And for that reason, he's a very important person because he did have quite a far-reaching impact. Now, he's a German Lutheran pastor and a theologian. He spends his career, about a 30-year career, teaching New Testament studies at the University of Marburg. And, of course, as you know, by the turn of the 20th century, these German universities and seminaries that if you went back a couple of hundred years before that would have been paradigms of evangelical orthodoxy, they virtually all become very, very liberal throughout the 19th century and by the turn of the 20th century. And Bultmann, again, sort of epitomizes that whole trend. Now, from his youth, he's trained and kind of drawn to the study of theology. His father and both of his grandfathers were Lutheran pastors. But again, see, by this time in Germany, most German pastors are theological liberals. Not all of them, but many of them are. And so after studying theology at some of the most prestigious universities in Germany, Bultmann settles into a comfortable teaching and writing career there at the University of Marburg. And one of his early influences as he's studying theology is Friedrich Schleiermacher. Now, Schleiermacher is one of those that we could have included in our list of 30 worst books ever written, because Friedrich Schleiermacher, he was a German philosopher, theologian, he was a Bible scholar. He's also referred to as the father of modern liberalism. So even here in America, American theological liberals held Schleiermacher in very high esteem. He's the one who probably has the earliest and greatest influence on theological liberalism. And according to Schleiermacher, the very core of Christianity, the essence of Christianity, is the realization that we live in a dangerous world, and perhaps he acknowledged that to some extent or another, we have personal problems. He might not have wanted to use the word sin, you know, but nonetheless, we need to realize our dependence upon God. But having said that, he had a very low opinion of the Bible and of biblical narratives, historical narratives. He didn't believe that they were much more than legend and mythology for the most part. And furthermore, he believes that what he would call dogmatic theology, and of course that term dogmatic is a pretty loaded term. You know, we usually use dogmatic in reference to, you know, people and opinions that we don't approve of. But see, for him, any kind of theological statement, even if it goes back to the original, some of the early Christian creeds, just basic core Christian beliefs, that's too dogmatic and restricting. So Schleiermacher, in other words, all that Christianity is Jesus lived an exemplary life. He was... he might not have correlated very much to what we read in the Gospels or in the New Testament, because after all, according to Schleiermacher, the Gospels in the New Testament are pretty unreliable as historical sources. But nonetheless, we still need to generate faith of some sort or another. But he was very vague as to exactly, you know, what that faith would be and what it entailed, okay? But anyway, he's sort of, like I said, the original theological liberal in Europe there, and others will just kind of come along and, you know, build on his foundation, you might say. Now, in the course of his studies in the university, Bultmann imbibed all the popular liberal theories of the day. He learned, for instance, that all modern theologians, all enlightened theologians, for instance, rejected the orthodox Christian creeds, like the Nicene Creed and so on. That's all those are outdated, according to the liberals. He also learned that Christianity was an invention of the early church, and it was a corruption of the teachings of Jesus. And we've talked about that, you know, in previous weeks. This idea that there's a stark contrast between the Jesus of history, who we encounter in the New Testament, and the so-called Christ of faith. And that Christianity and this belief in the divinity and the salvific atoning death of Jesus Christ, that's just a later invention, according to the liberals, okay? And Bultmann is imbibing all those kinds of ideas. And in the process, he comes to believe that what we would refer to as biblical history is really just mythology and legend for the most part. There might be traces of historicity in those accounts, but for the most part, they're not to be taken that seriously. And furthermore, he also adopts a very anti-supernaturalistic prejudice in this regard, that, again, the miracles that we encounter in Scripture, well, those are just rhetorical flourishes or literary flourishes inserted into the text just to dramatize maybe how great God is. But he doesn't believe for a minute that God actually intervenes in human affairs, you know. He does believe in God, but it's almost more of a deistic God who's disconnected and uninvolved in human affairs. So this is what Bultmann studies. This is what he comes to believe. And this is essentially what he dedicates his life to propagating. Now, unlike some of his contemporaries like Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Karl Barth, Bultmann never takes a strong stand, for instance, against Hitler and the Nazi regime. He's always very timid and very cautious about that. Now, early on, when Christians were beginning to form what they called the Confessing Church, in other words, a movement of true Christians opposed to the Nazi agenda, Bultmann actually associated with the Confessing Church early on. And he even signed their famous Barman Declaration, which they drafted, that held that our ultimate allegiance is to God and God alone, not to the state, and that there is a higher allegiance above and beyond nationalism and patriotism. So he actually signs that. And but having said that, his opinion of the Nazis and of Hitler, his opinions are sufficiently ambiguous and vague to the point that he actually goes through the entire Nazi period all the way up to the end of World War II. And unlike true Christians who were invariably persecuted, he makes out pretty well during the war. He keeps his prestigious teaching position at the university, never has to be called for account for what he believes, never really overtly criticizes the Nazi regime. And so basically, his career just continues uninterruptedly through World War II. Now, you know, when it comes to this issue of Christian persecution, we know that even, you know, oftentimes the most devout Christians will sometimes, their faith will falter under duress, under threat of torture and so on. And so that's just a concession to human nature, as we know. But see, for theological liberals, it's actually easier than that, because theological liberalism is by its very nature very flexible and very expandable. And so theological liberalism can be twisted and contorted, you know, to pretty much fit any particular agenda or the mood of any particular day and age. And I think that's what we see here in Rudolf Bultmann. Now, early on, when the Nazis have taken over, he speaks out against the militant nationalism of the Nazis. And he speaks out a little bit about their mistreatment of Jews. And he also is a little bit irritated by the dismissal of non-Aryan Christian ministers from the Lutheran Church in Germany. But again, he never really opposes the Nazi agenda publicly. And throughout the war years, as I said, he pretty much retains his chair there, his very prestigious position, and so on. Now, in fact, during World War II, Bultmann goes on to criticize many of his colleagues in the Confessing Church movement. And he criticizes them for holding on to what he calls outdated traditional Christian beliefs that are not suitable for the 20th century. So again, as a good liberal, he believes that our beliefs about God and certainly our view of the Bible and all, well, that changes over time because he sort of buys into the evolutionary whole scheme of things, and that is that we are progressing to higher levels of understanding and so on. So he criticizes those who are the most opposed to the Nazi regime and says they're too dogmatic, they're too rigid in clinging to traditional Christian teachings, and we need to be, again, more flexible and accommodating as far as that sort of thing goes. Now, one of his biographers puts it this way: Bultmann became an embarrassment to the Confessing Church. The man not only lacks moral courage, but he's also quite the hypocrite. See, throughout most of his career, in addition to his scholarly studies and his teaching at the university, he's also a Lutheran pastor who goes into his church every Sunday morning and goes through the traditional Lutheran liturgy, affirming the traditional creeds that uphold, of course, basic biblical orthodoxy and so on. So he does that on Sundays, and then he spends all the rest of the week in his classroom and in his scholarship refuting all those core tenets of the historic Christian faith. So what he does on Sunday morning, going through the Lutheran liturgy, has absolutely no correlation to what he really believes and what he's committed to, that is, you know, his passionate commitment to his own scholarship and study and so on. So the man is rather obviously quite the hypocrite. Let me just pause briefly here. Any comments or questions before we move on? Yes. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you mentioned the fact that they retain so much of Christian verbiage, but see, they give those key concepts a different meaning. For instance, liberals typically will avow that they believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, but what does that mean? See, do you believe in the physical bodily resurrection, the historical resurrection? And it's, no, we don't believe in that. We believe that the resurrection is really a metaphor for whatever, you know, maybe the power of God or the ultimate triumph of good over evil, that sort of thing. But you're right, they use a lot of the familiar lingo and terminology. All right, now, Bultmann is an early proponent of what we call form criticism. Now, form criticism is a method of biblical analysis that attempts to trace a passage in Scripture to its original oral tradition in order to try and determine its original form, okay? And Bultmann put it this way in one of his books: the aim of form criticism is to determine the original form of a piece of narrative, or a statement or a teaching or a parable. In the process, we learn to distinguish secondary additions and forms But these, in turn, shed light on the history of the gospel tradition. So essentially what form criticism does is say, you know, behind every or most everything we read in the Gospels and in the New Testament, those all started from an oral tradition. And they've probably been altered by the time they're written down and preserved, and by the time we get to read them. So how can we go back and recover what Jesus actually said and what he actually did without without the embellishments and so on that have been added to the story? So it sounds like a worthy field of study. And actually, philosophically, there's nothing wrong with form criticism. The problem here is that form criticism, and even liberals will generally concede this, form criticism is by its very nature highly speculative and very conjectural. Frankly, in most cases, you just don't know if there was this, if there was an oral tradition behind these stories, and then the stories got changed and altered over time before they were written down. In most cases, there's no evidence, which means there's no reason to believe that theory. But Bultmann really stakes a major part of his career on pushing that idea. But as I said, in recent decades, even among liberal scholars, form criticism has fallen out of favor. Even liberals are very skeptical of our ability to distinguish the, quote, original oral traditions from what was later written down and preserved in the sources that we have today, okay? All right, now, Bultmann is probably best known for demythologizing Scripture. And the way he'll put it is that the Bible is almost totally a compilation of ancient myths. And so, in other words, he'll believe that the Christian faith, in order to survive in the modern world, has to change. It has to be updated, and it has to be stripped of its supernatural elements. Because, after all, hasn't science proven that miracles are impossible, and so on? And of course, obviously, it hasn't. But that's their understanding. See, and so he'll argue that the true kernel of the gospel has to be separated from what he calls the outmoded husks of ancient superstitions and mythical cosmology. And this is what he intends to do in a lot of his scholarship. He calls this his new hermeneutic. In other words, what he's trying to do is extract the truths of Scripture from their mythological context in keeping with modern sensibilities. So he believes there's truth in the Bible. There's just no historical truth to really be concerned about. And furthermore, he's very reluctant to admit that there are core doctrines, that there are core Christian dogmas that have to be respected as well. Otherwise, it's not true Christianity whatsoever. So this is basically what he puts forth in a letter to Karl Barth in 1952, essentially this idea that the biblical writers were just products of their own time, as were Greek and Roman historians. And so just as we read Greek and Roman historical sources with a measure of skepticism, likewise we should apply the same standards to the history that we encounter in the Bible as well. But in his letter to Karl Barth, Bultmann writes, quote, "Sharing the mythical worldview of their age, the New Testament authors tell the story of the Christ event as a story of the gods, as a myth." So in other words, what we encounter in the New Testament, well, that's just kind of a Christianized version of the stories of the gods that we encounter in Greek and Roman mythology. Okay. Now, why is he so antithetical to belief in the supernatural and so on, or the historicity of Scripture? Well, it's all about Bultmann's worldview, his basic worldview. See, he believes that we live in a closed system and that God is not actively involved in human history. And this is how Bultmann puts it in one of his books, quote, "History is a unity in the sense of a closed continuum of effects," a closed continuum. That means that human beings and human beings alone make history. There is absolutely no divine superintendence over history. There's no divine involvement in human history. It's purely a product of human natural sources. He goes on to say, this closedness means that the continuum of historical happenings cannot be interrupted by the interference of the supernatural or by transcendent powers that therefore there is not a miracle in the proper sense of the word. He goes on to say, the mythical view of the world must be rejected in its entirety. So as theological liberals would tend to do, what Bultmann wants to do is eliminate the distinction between the supernatural and the superstitious. And you'll find that this is common among skeptics, whether they claim to be liberal Christians or whether they don't even claim to be Christians. And that is that they tend to conflate belief in the supernatural with belief in superstition, because to them it's all one and the same thing. Now, as Christians who have a profound respect for the supernatural, we should be among the least superstitious people, to say the least. But with again, the skeptics, it's all one and the same. And in fact, in a famous quote by Bultmann in 1941, and Germany is already involved in the war. We're in the midst of the Nazi era and so on. So in a famous quote, he declares that today it's impossible for anybody who uses electricity to believe in miracles or the New Testament world of demons and spirits. He's saying, that's just superstitious nonsense. People used to believe that stuff. But we live in the modern progressive age. We have electricity. I don't know what that's exactly got to do with it, but nonetheless, that's his point, that we've progressed beyond all of that mythology and nonsense. And furthermore, we don't believe in demons and spirits and things like that either. Okay. Let me again just pause briefly. Any input or comments on your part before we continue? Yes, Lou? Okay. Well, he of course would beg to differ, but it does sound like he's more of a deist than he is a theist. And so in other words, he does believe in God, presumably even believes in a personal God, not just an impersonal force. And presumably he believes that this God is the creator of the world and so on, but this God is remote and disconnected and uninvolved in human affairs. Now, the typical deist argument will be this. Look, we believe in an omnipotent God who created a world that operates perfectly according to natural laws, natural physical laws. And so it would be a lesser view of God to think that God has to intervene in his world or intervene in human affairs. That would imply that the world he created isn't perfect. So that would be the argument that the deists would put forth. We don't need divine intervention. We live in a well-constructed world, that operates according to natural physical laws. And furthermore, they'll argue that God has created humanity in his image, in the Imago Dei, and God has imbued us with at least great potential, brain power and great potential. And so we are perfectly capable of living in this world as God intended us to live. And we don't really need divine intervention. That would be a lower view of the majesty of God. So that's how they would put it. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Well, he's outside time and space, but he is personal. He's not just a force,
Yeah.
Well, that's a bit of a problem, say, and so that's one of many weaknesses with deism. Yeah, how do you account for innate sin and so on? they have no response, really. Bob?
Would Bolton have believed in the need for our redemption?
Oh, see, they use these terms, but it's hard to know what they even mean. See, now, his argument is that obviously humanity is out of sync with God's intention. So the goal in life, as he puts it, to use his word, is to live authentically, whatever that means, see. So we need to live authentically, and we need God's help to live authentically. But exactly what does that even mean anyway? Okay. And Bob.
Have you ever referred to what is their basis of belief? What is the source and confidence that they have? There's no scripture, there's no supernatural, there's no Christ, there's no sin, therefore no salvation, redemption. But what is their basis that they would say, is it just pure subjection?
Well, they believe that there are truths embedded in Scripture.
But they have to be the ones to determine which ones are right.
Yes, I suppose that's why you need theologians, is to help you. So there are truths embedded in Scripture, and God has seated, the Bible with truths. But that has nothing to do with the historicity of the Bible. And it has nothing to do with miracles. Miracles are merely examples. They're metaphors for the majesty and glory of God. After all, He did create the whole universe. But in order to exemplify the greatness of God, we make up these stories about miracles. See, but they didn't really happen. And again, see, as a good deist, he would argue that we don't need miracles. We've got everything we need in this natural world.
They don't believe God is miraculous.
Well, they must believe that creation was a miraculous event. But see, since then, God created a good world, and he no longer, he's never involved in his world. It's a, that's about, as sensible as it gets. Did you have a comment or question?
Much of what you're saying, okay, about is what Christianity is not.
Mm-hmm.
Asking what Christianity is.
Yeah. What is Christianity? It's living authentically as God would want us to live. And Jesus was the perfect example. Of course, we don't really know much about Jesus, do we? So it's kind of a self-refuting argument. Yeah. Oh, by the way, like all these skeptics, from Rudolf Bultmann to Thomas Jefferson and everybody in between, since they always argue that we can't really know that much about the historical Jesus, on what basis do they admire Jesus, see, if we don't really know that much about him? And what you find is they construct a Jesus in their own image. It's a Jesus that looks very much like them, who holds the same attitudes and opinions and values as they do. Or as one historian put it, they look down the well and they see the historical Jesus reflected in their own face. It's rather obviously subjective, to say the least. And I guess you could say it's rather obviously ego-centered. Now, as we said, Bultmann is steeped in German higher criticism, and he dismisses the historical basis for the Christian faith. He's going to be arguing that we can't know very much at all about Jesus because the New Testament's mostly mythological. It was really just intended to teach theology in story form. But again, see, he doesn't even hold a very high view of theology, because theology is really just about discovering the truths of God's character and nature. But if everything is kind of murky and subjectivized, then it even renders the study of theology kind of pointless, doesn't it? Because there's really not that much truth that you can gain through theological studies. But In fact, he'll argue, the New Testament writers were not even trying to write real history or real facts about Jesus. But that doesn't matter, because the historical narratives about Jesus are mostly just irrelevant anyway. The gospel narratives are mostly mythological. They are addressing a specific theological or practical problem that faced the Christian community early on. So they make up these stories and parables and miracles and so on in order to emphasize the salient issues of their day. One of Bultmann's biographers, Charlotte Allen, writes, quote, "Bultmann believed that the stories in the Gospels had grown like pearls from simple core aphorisms," in other words, sayings of Jesus, "into longer contextualized discourses and narratives." So for Bultmann, see, all that matters about Jesus is that he existed and that he preached and that he was crucified. Nothing else about Jesus really matters all that much. And this is how he puts it in his book, Jesus and the Word. "I do indeed think that we can know almost nothing about the life and personality of Jesus, since the early Christian sources show no interest in either." The early Christian sources show no interest in the life and personality of Jesus, and are moreover fragmentary and often legendary. And other sources about Jesus do not exist. So that pretty much encapsulates his Christology, his understanding of Christ, that he was a semi-historical figure. We don't know that much about him. The gospel writers had no intention of writing the true story of Jesus. They're interested in conveying theological truths. And so we just have to be content with that. But again, where do you draw the line? See, if you begin arguing that the Gospels don't give an accurate account of Jesus' life and teachings, how on earth would you ever know what he actually did and what he actually taught? And yet, these liberals seem very confident of themselves that they can tell us what Jesus actually did and taught. But it's all just subjectivism on their part. In other words, parts of the Jesus story that resonate with their own prejudices or values or opinions, they will affirm. Aspects of Jesus' life that don't resonate with their own belief system, they'll claim are not true and accurate. Okay. So as you see, there's no objective checks on their subjectivism. Bultmann is quite antagonistic when it comes to Christian apologetics. He says that faith has to be a determined act of our will, divorced from any proofs. And he'll say that a fact-based faith is in fact a failure of true faith, that genuine saving faith has absolutely nothing to do with historical facts about Jesus. What's truly important about Jesus, and this is really the key, what's truly important about Jesus is what Jesus represented. In other words, it's Jesus' symbolic significance that matters. And that would be true all the way through Jesus' life, right up to the resurrection. See, it doesn't really matter whether or not there was an actual resurrection. He seriously doubts that there was one. But what is it that the resurrection symbolizes? See, that's what matters. Okay. So what would be your critique of this whole mentality that Bultmann is putting out? How would you respond to a Bultmannian or a Bultmaniac? Can you hear him? Oh. Jay's asking, what was going on in... Yeah. Right. Well, in our Western tradition, theological liberalism is birthed in Germany, but very quickly it spreads all over Europe and Britain and eventually here to America as well. And so you're right. I mean, these kind of teachings you'll find very prevalent in many of the mainline Protestant denominations. Of course, it varies from church to church. You know, some are far more orthodox than others. But you'll find this kind of liberalism just pretty pervasive, even in Catholic Christianity. You know, there's liberal, theological liberals in the Catholic Church, and then there's traditionalists in the Catholic Church. So this kind of mentality, as you implied, is very common today. I mean, gee, Candler over here at Emory is, you know, a bastion of this sort of theology. Well, I don't know that much about what was going on in German Protestantism in the late 1700s and 1800s. I'm sure theological liberalism met with resistance there. But eventually, the theological liberals take over the institutions, all the major schools of religion and seminaries, just as, again, in our mainline Protestant denominations here in America, liberals dominate in those as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Answers and
that's right.
And our churches today,
that's right,
consider themselves conservative and evangelical, but with no apologetic training.
Yes.
We're wide open to this thing happening again.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, in our day and age, I mean, apologetics isn't optional. It's the very heart of the gospel. It's at the very heart of discipleship. It's just that most churches haven't caught on yet. But some have, you know, and there's more apologetics awareness today than there's ever been in American Christianity, but we need it desperately more today than ever before. Yeah. Well, let's move on here and sort of wrap things up on Bultmann. Now, for all his insistence that the historical Jesus was unknowable, Bultmann has some very definite ideas about Jesus, which he puts forth in his book, Jesus and the Word. Again, see, if we can't trust the historical sources, how does Bultmann purport to know anything about Jesus? And yet, Bultmann tells us a lot about Jesus, or at least his opinion of Jesus. For instance, he tells us that Jesus was not born in Bethlehem. He was born in Nazareth. And he was born of purely human parents. There was no virgin birth. Now, again, see, how does he know that? Okay. Well, he doesn't know it, but it's a natural outgrowth of his deistic, you know, naturalistic mindset, worldview. He tells us that Jesus was baptized by John the Baptist. Well, he got that one right. For a time, he says, Jesus belonged to John's ascetic sect of Jews. Not true, no evidence of that. But Jesus later broke with John and disavowed asceticism. Well, again, there's no evidence that John was ever, that Jesus ever joined some ascetic community led by John the Baptist. He goes on to tell us that, like other popular rabbis, Jesus gathered disciples around him. He got that one right. Jesus taught something akin to the Lord's Prayer, but something akin, but we don't know exactly what he taught. Jesus believed that he could work miracles, and he did some things that common ignorant people thought were miraculous, such as healing the sick and exorcising demons, but they were just deceived. Jesus didn't actually do these things, but his followers are all simpletons. They're all ignorant simpletons, peasants, and so they thought he could do miracles. Okay, maybe even they honestly thought he could do miracles. Jesus preaches an apocalyptic message and mistakenly thought that the world would end during his lifetime. He's crucified by Romans as the would-be Messiah, although, according to Bultmann, Jesus never really considered himself to be the Messiah. That's something that Christians later attributed to him. How does he know that? Well, he doesn't, does he? Jesus was not literally raised from the dead. His resurrection was really just metaphorical and symbolic. Okay. Now, by the way, How would you respond to, again, that's very common in liberal Christianity today. I remember my wife and I visiting a church years ago that some friends went to, and it was on Resurrection Sunday, and the pastor spoke on the resurrection, and he said precisely that there's no need to believe in physical bodily resurrection, that what matters is what the resurrection symbolizes. So I'm sure you find that a bit problematical, but how would we respond to a charge like that? Okay, and Paul is obviously referring to a physical bodily resurrection, okay? So I'd say that if the greatest challenge we face in life is a metaphorical symbolic death, then a metaphorical symbolic resurrection is just fine. That's all we need. But in fact, we face a much greater challenge in this life. We face an actual physical material death, don't we? And so a purely symbolic, metaphorical resurrection, frankly, doesn't do us any good at all, does it? Okay. So that, and again, the attestation from the rest of Scripture that make the issue very unambiguous. Okay. Yes? Yes, Well, and why don't liberals just invent their own religion? Okay. Yes, Yeah, with all the great tradition and institutions and all that are already in place and so on, but why not just go off and start your own religion? Good question. What would you... Okay, yeah, a lot has to do with just that. It's much easier to infiltrate, existing institutions and so on than to do the hard work of inventing a new religion and so on. So I think that's a major issue. Now, we shouldn't necessarily ignore the fact that some, and I don't mean by any means all, but some theological liberals do seem to have an intentional agenda to subvert and pervert the Christian faith. And again, I'm not by any means saying that most of them, do that intentionally, but I think there's ample evidence that some do. That's their agenda. And then there's others, of course, that are going to argue that for Christianity to survive in the modern world, Christianity has to modernize. It has to be updated. Now, if you go back at the history of theological liberalism in America, way back before the American Revolution is when it started, and a lot of those early liberals, I don't question their sincerity. They were living in the Age of Enlightenment. And they believed that modern science, as they understood it, and modern Enlightenment concepts had pretty much determined that miracles don't happen. They were trending toward deism. And I don't doubt that a lot of them were very sincere. And that is, we need to change Christianity in keeping with the times. Otherwise, people are going to check out. They'll think that Christianity is just hopelessly behind the times. In other words, Christianity, to use a current term, needs to get on the right side of history in their minds. See? And by the way, how would you respond to that issue, that we need to change not just secondary issues, but we even need to change some of the core beliefs of the Christian faith to make it relevant today? What would be your response, Bob? It hadn't exactly worked, has it? Yeah, as far as modernizing Christianity. Okay. What else would we say?
Most Christians, I think, when they're attacked like this, begin to proclaim what they believe is the truth. And they just get further attacked for the historicity and the racist in the background. Instead of asking them, but whoever attacked these, they're criticizing everything, whoever attacked their position and made them prove what they believe and what's based on.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost a joke when you hear this concept. The apologetic approach of asking questions.
Yeah. In other words, it would have been good for a you know, a Christian apologist to challenge or debate Boltman. I'm not sure back in those days that ever happened. But you know, where does he get his information, and on what basis does he make these pronouncements? You know, where's his evidence? That sort of thing. Right. Now, see, the fundamental flaw in that argument, and again, sometimes it's an honest argument by liberals or whatever, and that is we need to change Christianity in keeping with the times. Well, I would say that the true gospel message is always relevant because it's all about our core problem, and that is we're out of sync with God's will for our lives. We're sinners. And we need to be made right with God. Now, since human nature never changes, there's no evidence we're getting better, you know, as the millennia go by. Our basic problem as human beings never changes. So the gospel message, the core message, is always relevant. Now, again, in terms of how we present the gospel message, that's another matter. And that's a matter for fair discussion and debate, you know. But To change core fundamental beliefs is unnecessary, and because human nature, the same problems that the people in Jesus' time were wrestling with, and that is their sin and their disconnect from God. Well, that's our problem today as well. So the true gospel message is always relevant. You know, you don't have to change it in keeping with modern sensibilities. But that's the liberal mindset. See, they would argue, since they don't believe in the Bible, the authority of the Bible, they would say that we need to take our beliefs and values and opinions need to be shaped and conditioned by what modern science and psychology and sociology and anthropology, what the dominant themes and theories in those fields, that's what ought to determine what we believe, not the Bible. So that would be a fundamental, you know, difference there. Yes. Yeah, that's right.
If I were to ask Boltman, if I had one question to ask him, I'd probably say, what do you mean by truth?
Mm-hmm.
And if truth changes over time, then is it really truth?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, you know, unfortunately, Schenkel had to go to the concept of true truth.
Yeah, they want to play fast and loose with the definition. Yeah, good point. Well, let's not to be offensive about this, but let's kill Boltman off up here, so we can move on to other things. Okay, so here's a critique: if most of Scripture is mythical, why should we even believe in God, for that matter? See, I mean, we could just go all the way because Scripture teaches belief in God, just like it teaches the truths of Jesus Christ. Also, how does one separate the true teachings of Jesus from the life of Jesus? The great theologian George Eldon Ladd put it this way: the uniqueness of the Christian faith is in the mediation of revelation through real historical events. This is one of the distinguishing features of the Christian faith, the mediation of revelation. In other words, God has revealed himself through the medium of real historical events. And that's to be taken very seriously. That's one of the fundamental, unique elements of the Christian faith. Now, if Christ's atoning death and resurrection are merely mythical events, in other words, if they didn't actually happen, how can they provide any real atonement or assurance? How can they provide real atonement or assurance of the Christian's own resurrection? As I said, Our greatest challenge in life is not that we'll face a metaphorical symbolic death, but we'll face a real physical death. And that necessitates a real physical bodily resurrection. In denying the historicity of Jesus, Bultmann creates a purely imaginary Jesus in his own image. And the apologist Ben Witherington of Asbury Seminary puts it this way: the problem with separating the Jesus of history from the Christ of faith is that despite numerous attempts in this century to turn Christianity into merely a philosophy of life, it is and has always been a historical religion, one that depends on certain foundational events, particularly the death and resurrection of Jesus, a faith that does not ground the Christ of personal experience in the Jesus of history is a form of docetic or Gnostic heresy, for it implies that what actually happened in and during the life of Jesus is inconsequential to Christian faith. So let me just end on this note. Bultmann has a profound impact, not just on European heretical, you know, pseudo-Christianity, but here in America as well. He directly influences later generations of radical scholars. Several of the radical scholars that are associated later with the Jesus Seminar, many of you are familiar with the Jesus Seminar, this very extreme radical left-wing fringe of theologians and so-called Bible scholars. Many of these people, like James Robinson and Burton Mack, many of these people studied directly under Rudolf Bultmann. And so, again, you could say that the most radical fringe that we have today in terms of Bible scholars were influenced directly or indirectly by Rudolf Bultmann, as many other liberal theologians have been as well. So quite a significant person, and as we said, sort of the paradigm of theological liberalism in the 20th century. Any closing thoughts on Bultmann before we move on? Well, he was a good enough German. He survived World War II, and that's a good question. And actually, I don't know as much about his life as I should, really. So I'm not sure exactly how to answer that. I mean, but he was very much in the mainstream of German biblical scholarship and theology, you know, in the 20th century. You're right. Yeah. Good question. Now, again, he studied under the foremost liberals of his day, so he just pretty much, you know, accepted that. But you're absolutely right. These big wars, you know, you could say the same thing about the American Civil War as well as World Wars I and II. These are watershed events, and you see the disintegration of European Christianity after World War I. Yeah. All right, well, let's move on. The next book there on our list, but I don't want to give it much attention at all, is Alfred Kinsey's work, Sexual Behavior in the Human Male. And definitely one of the most influential books of the 20th century. It's a book in which Kinsey tried to provide clinical scientific evidence in support of the sexual revolution. See, now we've talked about Margaret Sanger, who had almost this mystical view of sexual libertinism, and we've talked about Margaret Mead, who went and did very sloppy and probably dishonest research in the Pacific Islands and concluded that unlike Westerners, modern Westerners that are hung up on sex, people who live more primitive lifestyles and all have a healthier, more free and open view towards sexuality. But see, nobody necessarily would consider either Sanger or Mead to have any, quote, scientific evidence behind their beliefs. So that's where Kinsey comes in, and he provides that scientific evidence for the sexual revolution. But the man is utterly, utterly dishonest. And his research, and this has been pointed out by his biographers as well as critics, there was nothing credible about this man and his research whatsoever. He was, without a doubt, one of the great frauds of the 20th century. And in his own personal life, the man was a hopelessly sick pervert. And that's no exaggeration. He was also, incidentally, a militant atheist who hated Christianity, but nothing new or novel about that, you know, in terms of the kind of authors and books we've been talking about. This guy is so perversely dishonest. Let me give you just one fact that he derived from his research, okay? And I'll let this stand for the credibility of his whole career, for that matter. According to Kinsey, 17% of boys who were raised on a farm have had sex with animals before they reach adolescence. And nearly half of all adults who have lived their lives on a farm have had sex with animals. Were you aware of that? And of course, it's totally fallacious. It's a total lie. And yet, as I said, that pretty much represents the credibility and the quality of his research as he seeks to make every kind of sexual expression normal. Everything from homosexuality to bisexuality to even pedophilia. He actually advocated pedophilia. And he also actually advocated bestiality, sex with animals, okay? He said, oh, it's been going on throughout all of human history. What's the big deal? You know, why are we so hung up on that? So I think that's probably more than enough time to spend on Kinsey, considering that we've got more important things to talk about. An absolute fraud. And, of course, his views accepted as legitimate and propagated through popular culture and through popular media. We were talking a little bit before class. There was a movie that came out just a few years ago on, Paul was mentioning this, a movie that came out just a few years ago on Kinsey's life, starring Liam Neeson. And, Playboy magazine played an integral part in really promoting Kinsey and his research and so on. So if you're satisfied, I'd like to move on, okay? He's just too slimy and seedy, even for our study. we do have some quality control here, believe it or not, all right? Yes, yeah, Julie? No. This is a I think you're speaking of James Robison or Robison, however he pronounced his name. And no, this is somebody else. This guy was again one of the titans in liberal Christianity in the 20th century. Yeah. All right. Now, of all the books on our list, this next one and its author may be the least familiar. If we were to take a poll, whoever's heard of Theodore Adorno? Well, in fact, who has? Dan, I know you would. Has anybody else even heard of this guy? And yet, he's exceedingly influential. Now, this is what Adorno puts out. There's a prototypical fascist personality type. There's certain people who by nature are fascists. And it's characterized by people who hold the conventional and traditional moral values and behavior. In other words, social conservatives, what we would call social conservatives, are innately prone to fascist tendencies. Okay, so social conservatives, see, are not just honestly mistaken. They're not just honestly wrong on a lot of the social and political issues of our day. Instead, they are mentally and morally inferior. They cling desperately to outdated beliefs and practices that are radically out of sync with modern realities and beliefs that are impediments to human social progress. Now, consider the genius of this, see? If you could make the case that your opponents are not just honest people who just don't quite know the facts, they're honestly mistaken, if you could instead twist it to say that your opponents are perverts or they are mentally inferior, they suffer from mental illness and so on, then you've got quite an advantage, you know, in the debate, the ongoing debate. And that's Theodore Adorno's great contribution. And that's why you've probably noticed throughout your lifetime, many in the elite circles of liberalism in America, in academia, in the media, and even popular culture and so on, why is it that they're so disdainful of people that hold the conservative social values, or why are they so disdainful of Christians, conservative Christians? See, because they don't, for a moment, accept us as being on their level. They're absolutely convinced that intellectually and mentally and even morally, we're very much beneath them. So oftentimes you'll notice, why aren't colleges and universities more open to honest, fair debate between, for instance, conservatives and liberals? Well, their argument would be conservatives are so ignorant and so inferior that they have no right to express their views in the university. So again, see, if you could make that case, and they have very, very conclusively there over the last 60 or 70 years, then it pretty much excludes Christians and social conservatives from the public square. And that's precisely what they want to do, is exclude us from the public square. Our views are not even worthy of being aired. And that's part of the initial outrage over Fox News. Why would you even want a major TV network that had conservatives on it? Their views aren't even worth hearing, you know. So anyway, with that, let's move forward here. Now, Adorno and his little elite group of neo-Marxists will put forth this idea that traditional mainstream America, which they spell with a K, America with a K, is innately fascist. Anytime you see America spelled with a K, you know, which was fashionable back in the 60s with the New Left and so on, the implication is that America is an innately fascist nation. And what Adorno will argue is that there's a latent fascism in the American soul as a result of America's heritage of capitalism, racism, sexism, imperialism, and of course, Christianity. All those things, from capitalism to Christianity, contribute to this fascist mentality that traditional Americans uphold. And now he's basing his assumptions on Freud's very dubious theory of the unconscious. See, most of these inferior people, most of these conservatives and Christians, they don't realize they're inferior, you know, and they don't realize that they're actually a bunch of fascists. They are, but it's kind of buried, you know, beneath the conscious level. It's part of their unconscious being. And again, as we talked about a few weeks ago, that's very Freudian, isn't it? Okay. All right, now, Adorno's strategy, see, is to associate conventional middle-class values with fascism. He considers it to be a mental illness. And his approach, as I said, is as brilliant as it is dishonest. And in many respects, he defines the rules of engagement in the culture war. by putting conservatives and Christians very much on the defensive. See, again, if you can convince people that your opponent is not just honestly misinformed, but is actually inferior, then you know that takes you a long way toward, you know, victory in the propaganda wars. Now, who is this guy? Well, Theodor Adorno is one of the premier neo-Marxist social philosophers. He was associated with what's called the Frankfurt School in Germany, the Frankfurt School's Institute of Social Research. These were all a bunch of cultural Marxists that came along after World War I, and they really flourished in Germany in the 1920s. Then, when the Nazis took over in the early 1930s, these neo-Marxists scattered like rats from a sinking ship. Now, it's interesting. See, they're all, basically, they're communists. They're just neo-communists. They're neo-Marxists. And yet, interestingly, when they had to flee Germany, well, they had two options. They could flee east or they could flee west. So where do they go? None of them went east. None of them went to the Soviet Union. They all headed to the most open and free societies in the world. They all headed to Britain and to America. And when they got to America, many of them, like Adorno, got very prestigious teaching positions at Columbia University in New York City, where they would have pretty much a nationwide and, you know, beyond that, maybe even a worldwide audience. Okay. So Adorno grows up in a very cultured family in Germany. His mother is a Catholic. She's a very gifted musician. His father converted from Judaism to Protestantism. Now, generally speaking, not always, but generally speaking, when a German Jew converted to Protestantism, there was an ulterior motive, and that was these are people that were seeking social position, social status, social acceptability. Again, not always, but oftentimes that was the case. Now, Adorno studies music composition and philosophy at the University of Frankfurt. And then, as I said, in 1933, the Nazis take over, and he and all of his neo-Marxist associates are expelled from the university, some of them because they had non-Aryan ancestry and also because they were communists. They had this Marxist ideology. So he immigrates to America, and he works very closely with the founder of the Frankfurt School, who had also come to America before him, a man named Max Horkheimer. They're both based there at Columbia University. And after World War II, he returns back to Germany and begins teaching at the University of Frankfurt for the rest of his career from 1949 to 1969. Now, this is a little bit of an aside, but I think it's a very interesting point with Theodor Adorno. As I said, he actually studied philosophy and musicology in the university. He was a radical musicologist, and he understood the power of music, and he understood the cultural and the propaganda value of the arts, in particular music and movies. And he questions whether any true legitimate art could survive in a capitalistic society in which everything is driven by the profit motive. See, we have a big commercial music industry, and it's all part of the capitalistic system. And so Adorno would take the position that nothing that's produced in this capitalistic music industry has any value whatsoever. It's just a pawn and a tool of capitalism. So the man hated popular culture. He hated popular music. And he said, you know, all that capitalism does, it takes art, whether it's movies, music, whatever, and it turns art into marketable commodities. And by the way, he's very accurate that there's a lot of truth in all that. It's not totally true, but there is some truth in that view. And so Adorno would instead see art as a major front in the culture war. And he believes that the only legitimate art and music are those that challenge the commercially defined sensibilities of the middle class. See, the middle classes, according to these elitist neo-Marxists, the middle classes are the dumb masses, okay? And so he has no respect for middle class conventional values. And so, in other words, in modern terminology, music needs to be edgy. It needs to push the limits if it has any credibility at all. And if you know much about popular music, I mean, again, see, much of that field has bought into this idea that to be legitimate, music has to push the limits, whether it's in terms of its message. So we get all these obscene lyrics and all, see, but that's okay because they're pushing the limits. It's edgy, see. Music is supposed to set people on edge. It's supposed to be a revolutionary force. And that's very much what Adorno would advocate. Furthermore, Adorno believes that capitalism and traditional Christian-influenced society is so decadent and so repulsive that the music should reflect anger and angst. In other words, it's illegitimate to produce beautiful music because we live in such a horrid society and culture. Say, so the only legitimate music is music that's very tense and edgy and confrontational. I'm sure he would have loved gangsta rap. I'm sure he would have loved heavy metal music, say, because it's discordant and it's not pretty. It's not, you know, particularly melodic, to say the least. And so for him, that's the only legitimate kind of art, because again, capitalism is so horrible. And there needs to be a revolution. Capitalism needs to be destroyed. And everything that upholds capitalism, including the arts, need to be, you know, vanquished as well. Yes? Well, in its nascent forms, it actually starts in medieval monasteries, but to sort of update the story. Yes, it. Well, I mean, Adam Smith in fascism, yeah, fascism properly defined is statism. It's state control. Now, you can have degrees of it, of course. And so fascism, in its broadest sense, would incorporate Nazism, communism, extreme socialism, so on. Yeah. Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah. Well, no, actually, it's a 19th century development. And well, he's a Marxist, and so he very much buys into traditional Marxism. The reason we call people like Adorno neo-Marxists is because they understood, and Dan would be a great source on this, they understood that the classical Marxist revolutionary theory didn't really work in modern industrialized Western societies. So the best way to take over in a country and eliminate capitalism and impose communism, the best way is not through a violent revolution of the working class, but rather it's through subverting the culture, and which means the education system, the political system, the legal system, the arts and entertainment, and so on. So that's why we call these people neo-Marxists or cultural Marxists. And they have been fantastically successful, you know, as the current political situation dramatizes, I think. That's, yeah, yeah, pretty much unopposed, yeah. And, you know, when we talk about a thoughtful Christian critique of all this, well, Francis Schaeffer is sort of a starting point. I mean, not that there weren't Christians before Schaeffer that addressed some of these issues, but as far as, again, kind of a thoughtful, systematic critique of all this, it starts with Schaeffer, and Schaeffer, well, that's the 1960s, isn't it? Schaeffer is in the 60s and 70s, and until that time, there wasn't much at all when it comes to what we would call cultural apologetics. So you're right, these people pretty much have a free ride, and they continue because, again, of the low status of apologetics in our churches, and especially cultural apologetics. See, but if we actually love people like Jesus commanded us to love God, love others as we love ourselves, we're going to be concerned about every aspect of a person's life. And to truly love somebody and to be totally uninterested and disconnected and disengaged from politics is just irresponsible. Politics has a profound impact on the quality of people's lives. And if we actually love people, then we're going to have to attend seriously to what's going on in the culture and the political culture as well. But so many Christians seem to have this mentality that they're so spiritual, they're above and beyond politics. Because politics is all dirty and grimy, and it is, a lot of it, isn't it? But that's the world we live in. And we need to deal with the real world and real world conditions. Dan?
I have 70 seconds.
65. Yeah.
What
60 now.
Okay, that's fine. I'm
50.
First of all, I'm only about 6% as smart as he thinks I am because I get most of my material from him. So speaking of which, yeah, what he was saying about what Jeffrey was saying about the taking over of the various arts and culture and
yes.
That's what they
yes.
wanted was, okay, you guys all got your college degrees,
mm-hmm.
you're all leftist or new leftist,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, don't worry about revolution, just go get a tenure professorship,
mm-hmm.
professoriate, whatever, just take
mm-hmm.
over, and pretty soon everybody will think
mm-hmm.
like we do, and
mm-hmm.
it's all done, and then we have our Marxists without the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
There's more at the Areopagus website. If you go to the top of the website, it says articles. Jeffrey has this wonderful series. You have to go down a little ways. It's got a history of political correctness and cultural Marxism.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Parts 1 and 2. Strongly recommend.
Yeah.
Wikipedia has an entry that's called Frankfurt School Conspiracy Theory, which makes it sound like it's darker than it is. But yeah, it's history. It's recent
mm-hmm.
history. But it's
mm-hmm.
history. And this all happened. So it's
mm-hmm.
not quite, you know, like some frantic
mm-hmm.
conspiracy theory. And
I think your time was up about 5 seconds ago, actually. Seriously. Does it come to mind? Anything? Okay. Anything else? Yes. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, religious liberty, what famous American politician in recent years said that the First Amendment guaranteeing religious liberty was probably our most cherished right? Who said that? Bill Clinton said that. See, so that's what Democratic liberals said 20 or so years ago. Now you see how dramatically it's changed. Now religious freedom has to be subjugated in the interest of political correctness, and in particular the advancement of a LGBT agenda. So things are changing so rapidly. And of course, today, Bill Clinton wouldn't even admit that, would he? But back then, 20 years ago, he did. Yeah, yeah, well, good cause for it. Let me... A couple more comments, and then I'll make a brief comment, and we'll finish. Lou?
Have you heard the term whiteism?
No, but I'm probably guilty of it or something. I'm not sure. What is it anyway?
It sounds much like the statement
sex is an imperialism of Christianity.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay, all right, okay. Yeah, yeah. See, and I think as in general as a nation, we would be so far beyond race today if it weren't for these people that continue to fan the flames of racial tension and conflict. Of course, I understand. I interact with a very impressive network of people, but, you know, I don't know anybody that's hung up on race these days. Things have changed dramatically, and for the best, you know. But
the only thing I can determine is it's a mixture of capitalism, racism, imperialism, and Christianity.
Oh.
I mean, it's not just racism.
Yeah. So it's condensed into condensed. Yeah. Well. Sure. And of course, on the most radical extremes of the left and the political correctness movement, they're even calling us to account for speciesism. We consider human beings superior to other animals, and that's not politically correct. You know, we're no better than the, you know, aardvarks and the zebras. You know. Perhaps so, yeah. Dan, and then again, just a brief comment on my part.
As for Christians being AWOL on the intellectual battle, absolutely. Schaefer calls it the task for not paying attention to the Armory Show in 1915. All this modern art from Europe was shown in New York, and it was like this totally, basically, if you understood the art and what the statements were, it was this total change of philosophy. You know, it was a wrenching change away from anything like a Judeo-Christian basis for Western civilization. If we listened to what these people were saying, we would have paid attention. But even in the 50s, we largely speaking, most of Christendom wasn't paying attention, and yet all the pieces were in place.
Yes.
The explosion that was the later 60s.
That's right.
In fact, if you go see this, I recommend it. It's kind of, you have to fasten your seatbelt, because it's tough to watch it, given what we know will happen subsequently. But there's a very early 60s movie, I want to say 62, 63, and it's a Jimmy Stewart movie. They both told me wholesome and homey and stuff like this. It's called Take Her, She's Mine.
Hmm.
Jimmy Stewart's daughter in the movie, she goes off to college, and she learns about communism and the sexual revolution and all the stuff, and all the stuff in Paris, and getting arrested, and it's all supposed to be, oh, this is all fine, and, you know, sort of a boys movie, boys attitude about modern stuff. But, you know, if you were back home, you know, in Indiana, and you saw this in 62, you would be ready for what happened, you know, on the campuses in 68 and 70. You would be ready for May 68 in Paris and all that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and seeing what's taken place, you know, on spring break down in Panama City, you know, in the last couple of weeks and all, and reminded me of a movie I saw when I was, I don't know, 12 or something, Where the Boys Are, starring Connie Francis, about spring break, circa 1961 or 62, and what an incredible contrast, you know, in that. Well, Dan's comment about Antonio Gramsci, one of the early cultural Marxists in the early 20th century, his master plan was, look, we're never going to foment a revolution in America or Britain through violent means by organizing the working classes like Marx had said we need to do. Instead, we need to infiltrate the institutions. Now, when I started my academic career at Georgia State, there were quite a few in the department at the time who I would call sort of old New Deal liberals. You know, they were great admirers of Roosevelt and John F. Kennedy and so on. And some of these men were, you know, decent fellows and all. Now, what I noticed was there was a tendency on their part to not just tolerate but appreciate anybody who was more liberal than they. But when it came to people that were more conservative than they weren't nearly so so tolerant. And then by the time we got to the mid-80s and late 80s, more and more coming into the department had come out of the 60s radical movements and gotten, you know, history PhDs and so on. And so over the years, the department politically moved further and further left. Let's see, that'd be that way for you. Okay. And what I noticed was that this new generation of liberal left-wing professors weren't anywhere near as tolerant as the nice liberals that I had initially encountered. So over time, this is how these people take over. And they are just absolutely intolerant. Again, they, like Adorno, they have abject contempt for people that hold to traditional values. And so over a period of decades, obviously, your history department and other departments are going to get more and more left-wing in their orientation and more imperious and more intolerant. And so I saw it, you know, sort of microcosm there. But it's gone on in every university you can imagine in America. I think Adorno's so important that we ought to come back and talk a little bit more about him next week. So I think it would be time well spent. So let's do that. And we have two more sessions. So we'll finish up on Adorno. And I'd really like for you to understand this person and his great contributions. And then we'll move on to probably Saul Alinsky, Rules for Radicals. And then maybe our last session, we can look at Richard Dawkins and the God Delusion. Probably the most recent book on our whole list there. So as always, it's a great pleasure being with you, and love the interaction, and nothing's more impressive than getting to interact with Christians who take their faith seriously and want to broaden and deepen their knowledge base. And it certainly, you know, is a great inspiration to me as well. So blessings on your Holy Week and Resurrection Sunday come up. I always say, if you go to church on Resurrection Sunday and they don't sing Christ the Lord is Risen Today, you should sue the church for malpractice. So, and actually, I'm fairly serious about that. So I hope wherever you go to church on Sunday, they will do just that, and that it'll be a great blessing to you. Well, not acceptable substitute, but it's a great song. But Christ the Lord is Risen Today, that's one of those we'll be singing in heaven for the rest of eternity. So.